So my mom gave me a family heirloom last night.
Heirloom tomato?
Good one, Alan.
Thanks.
A family heirloom tomato. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's been cool. Is it kitchen related?
Yeah.
Okay.
She gave me her mom's bean pot.
Okay. What the heck is a bean pot?
It's like a, what would you call that? It's a crock, basically.
Okay.
A crock with a lid, and it's like ceramic. And it's kind of like this sides bulge out a little bit. I'm assuming originally it was purposed to make baked beans.
Right. Okay.
But yeah, it's like a really great ceramic crock. It's probably 4 liters, maybe something like that. 3.5, 4 liters.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't know if I talked about it on the show, but like, kind of recently I started reorganizing my kitchen. Oh, I think I talked about reorganizing my kitchen on the show.
You did, yeah.
But part of that was like freeing up some space in a room in my basement to potentially be able to do some fermentation.
Okay.
But I haven't really started on any fermentation yet because I don't really have crocks for one thing, or like I was gonna try and maybe make some koji and a dehydrator, but I don't have a dehydrator, so
right,
I've just been sort of like waiting to figure out what kind of like project I'm gonna do.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm definitely gonna make kimchi.
I thought for sure that your first bean pot project would have been cassoulet.
Well, I mean, cassoulet doesn't take very long, and so I could make cassoulet and then start on kimchi, but...
Oh, okay.
But the first thing that I thought of when I saw the bean pot was kimchi.
Okay.
I was like, oh. And then I told my sister tonight that I was going to make kimchi, and she was like, oh, no.
Because it's so stinky, is that why?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, okay.
A, she doesn't really like kimchi that much, and then... Oh. B, I think she thinks it's going to stink up the whole house or something. But I'm sure it's not going to stink up the whole house.
No, it should be fine. Like the, because usually, I know you said you had an area in your basement set aside, but I think like kimchi will ferment fine in the fridge.
Oh, yeah, that's fair.
And it can even be like, I mean, if the crock has a heavy lid, it shouldn't be a huge deal, but it can even be wrapped.
Mostly sealed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, Alan, there's no room for the bean pot in the fridge.
Oh, okay. All right, so, well.
Will it work in the basement? It should, right?
Well, yeah, it'll certainly work. I think if Harold McGee has a really wonderful, even a table in on Food and Cooking, or at least the edition that I have, where compares sauerkraut and kimchi. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he says is that the cooler fermentation, like kimchi is usually just above fridge temperature, like I don't care, remember 6 to 8 Celsius. Whereas sauerkraut is usually more like cellar temperature, like 15 to 20 Celsius. And that just encourages different microbes, like
bacterial
the ones
growth. Yeah.
For kimchi being those like ones that produce a lot of gas and give it the kind of effervescence. Whereas the sauerkraut ones, a little bit more yeasty and floral kind of things going on, but I'm sure it's fine, Shale. It'll be just fine. Or you'll invent a new thing entirely, maybe.
If only. I'm sure whatever it is I would invent has already been invented. Anyway.
Don't be so hard on yourself.
I'm not. I'm just saying, like... It's nothing new under the sun, Alan. Mm-hmm. Somebody somewhere has done it, whether I've heard about it or not, whether I've heard about it enough to be able to ignore that it existed. Well, that's a different story.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Alan Sedeby. I'm here with my co-host, Shale McDonald. Hello, Shale.
Hey, Alan.
We're two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food and we love to talk about it. And Shale. Okay. So
wait, let me guess. Follow-up.
It is follow-up, but it's got a nice little segue because you're like, oh, kind of Eeyore over here. Oh, well, I'm sure I could never invent something new. But, okay, I've got something to tell you, and I'm curious to, it is follow-up, or it calls back to something that you've talked about on the show, but it just came up today, and I'm excited to tell you about it. We are, last year, this time, we were talking about me doing the Certified Chef de Cuisine, the CCC, program. And it's that time of year again. And so there are, candidates, who will be coming to Nate, for their kitchen day, just 3 days after we're recording this.
That makes sense because last year I got back from Japan, like right around now. And then it was only a few days later that I came and helped you out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there is one, a Nate employee who is a candidate this year, who, is practicing, and, his name is Anthony. He's actually been mentioned on the show before, but, he has I'm going to say it in French once, and then I'm just going to say it in lazy English the rest of the show, but he has a beurre rouge on his menu. He has a beurre rouge on his menu.
Yeah. Beurre rouge.
This year they have to have an emulsified butter sauce. And so he's elected to make a beurre rouge.
Cool.
And he's been practicing this dish that's salmon and beurre rouge.
This is the Anthony that I know, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've tasted this dish a couple times now. It's wonderful. One thing that Anthony and I had discussed about his dish was that the color of the beurre rouge it's correct, and it's how I've always seen the sauce look. But it's kind of like a mauve. It's like a pale mauve color.
Yeah, I've never liked the like real color of that sauce.
Yeah, and especially when it's being served with this like beautiful piece of Atlantic salmon that's like dark orangey pink, well, salmon colored. It just like whatever, it's fine. That's what that sauce looks like. But we were kind of hemming and hawing about it, and he was starting to throw around ideas like, oh, maybe I should put beets in my red wine reduction or something to try and like bolster that color.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's part one.
Okay.
Part two is one time while he was practicing, and this almost never happens, I'm sure, but this one time when he was practicing and I was in the kitchen, he was making that sauce and he broke it. It split while he was adding the butter.
That can happen.
And I kind of like threw out this idea. I was like, well, you know my friend Shale, right? Well, he says, if you break a butter sauce, you can just boil it. And something will happen and you'll reach some kind of ideal balance of water and fat. And if you catch it at the right time, then it'll just re-emulsify and it's fine.
Uh-huh.
I've never done it. And I don't really believe that it works because it sounds like BS to me, but that's what I said
like
to Anthony.
Yeah,
that's
what
I said to Anthony.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So today, that's part two. Today I was at work and Anthony was practicing or had been practicing.
Yeah.
And so he said, okay, so I did that Shale thing.
Uh-huh.
He was practicing again and it broke. And so he started boiling it and he was like, and yeah, it's kind of like Anthony is also, Red Seal Baker. And so he's like much more comfortable with pastry and sugar work and everything than I am. But he was like, it's kind of like, when you're boiling syrup and it reaches a certain consistency, viscosity, like that's what happens with his beurre rouge as he's boiling it. And as soon as he recognizes that, he took it off the heat. I think he said he chilled it briefly over ice water just to bring it down to serving temperature and make sure it didn't get away from him. And he said, yep, sure enough, it came together. So first I'll say, sorry for all the terrible things I said about you and that idea that I didn't think was true. That's the first part. But something else even more interesting happened, or at least as interesting.
Okay.
The color, and I wasn't there to see it, but he showed me pictures, and actually he retried it tonight. And as I was looking at my phone for updates on the Oilers game, I was also getting updates from Anthony as he was retrying this Burr Rouge technique.
Wow, what a stressful night for you. It was.
The color is shockingly different and much better after it's done this boiling and re-emulsification, after it's been basically intentionally split and boiled and re-emulsified. Mm-hmm. It is not a pale mauve. It is the color of, it's like a purple red wine color.
Oh, that's interesting.
And Anthony has a theory about this.
Okay.
And I'm going to totally ruin this because I don't fully understand it all. But after he saw this, he was reflecting on, apparently there's a technique when you're working with buttercream, that has food coloring in it. Mm-hmm. He said that even whether you're working with water-based or oil-based food dyes, you can take some of the buttercream out and put it in the microwave to melt it and basically split it, like ruin your butter emulsion, and then slowly reincorporate some of that back into the original mass of buttercream, and it makes the color much more saturated. Darker. And it's something like to do with like once it's split, whether it's oil-based or water-based, it kind of like is able to be more fully absorbed by whatever that component is in the buttercream, and it makes the color much more striking. And he's wondering if the same thing is happening with this, where like if you have this red wine and butter emulsion, and then if you split it, it somehow makes some component of the pigment more like better absorbed, or it doesn't disperse light in the same way, or whatever it is. But
right, yeah, that's what I would assume, is that like, because I mean, here's my pet theory, is that like when you are making the emulsion originally, you know, like there's something about emulsions. There's something about, you know, like fat being encapsulated by liquid, or liquid being encapsulated by fat, that does something to, disperse light in a certain way, like reflect light rather than let it pass through. So like, which is why most emulsions have a light or white color. It's why, like, you take, you know, oil that is clear, turn it into mayonnaise, and it turns white, basically.
Right. Yeah.
And so when you're originally making the emulsion, you're stirring in the butter, and the butter is staying really well emulsified, and you're building up that emulsion. And that is, causing the color to be very pale. Mm. But then, once it breaks, then you have like maybe an oil component that is colored by because like originally the pigment is in your water component.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But then after it breaks, maybe that allows the oil component to absorb some of the pigment, and then when it re-emulsifies, you get a richer color because both of the water and the oil component are able to use the pigment or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting.
It's really fascinating to me because it's kind of like, maybe this information is on some blog or in some Cooking Issues episode that I haven't listened to, but like, it seems like this is revolutionary to me. It's like, because I've always hated the way that Burr Rouge looked. Like it looks kind of, I don't know. It looks not gross, but it just, the color is not very natural.
Pink
looking
and purple and food can be a little weird, I feel like, you know, and especially when they're not a vibrant aspect of that color. Like,
yeah. Like I can picture a color palette that the traditional color of Burr Rouge kind of plays into, but like most of the ingredients that it's paired with aren't really part of that. I don't know. So I just feel like all the textbooks have to be rewritten now or something. I don't know.
Yeah. I'll bet if you ask Ferran Adrià about this, he's like, oh yeah, it's because of this. You know?
Yeah. I'm sure. Yeah, that was on our
menu.
I'm
sure it's like a known concept or something. Just a little clarification too. Just I think like, so, and I don't know, maybe this is what's happening and you're just not really mentioning this part of it. But like for me, for the fixing of a butter sauce, once it's split, part, like a big part of that process is you have to add in additional liquid. Right. Because usually the reason why the butter sauce breaks is because you have, there's just not enough liquid to keep the emulsion whole or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And that's usually why when you're making a butter sauce and you've got a small amount of liquid and you're whisking in the butter, that liquid is still evaporating the whole time that you're adding the butter. And adding the butter is kind of a slow process. And so the whole time that you're adding the butter, the liquid's evaporating. And eventually, like, you have this point where there's just not enough liquid to keep the emulsion stable, and then it can break. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to make sure that while you're whisking your butter, you do have enough liquid, but just enough so that you can evaporate just enough of it so that when you have all of your butter in there, you get to this point where the sauce is emulsified, mm-hmm. which is why making the sauce is kind of tricky. And then if it does break, the way to save it is like, yeah, add back in some additional liquid. And then, yeah, you can boil the shit out of it. You can whisk the shit out of it. You can start adding in more cold butter. Like, there's a few ways to fix it. But, mm-hmm. yeah. Glad that's been working. That's great. And don't worry, Alan. I don't take it personally when you are skeptical about my cooking science claims. You should be skeptical. That's right. What science is all about.
Okay, I'll keep doing it.
Okay, good. Well, that's a nice piece of feedback. So how's Anthony feeling? Is he feeling like pretty confident?
Oh yeah. He's
good.
Very, very well prepared. Yep.
That's excellent.
Nice.
Best of luck.
Too.
Oh, right on. Yeah. Hope he does well. Mm. I also have some feedback. See if I can pull it up here. Not nearly as fun as yours really, but.
Oh.
Okay. Feedback number one, Vietnamese meatballs. Do they have starch in them? That was kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. So the springy beef balls.
Yep.
I think they're called Bo Vien, something like that. I don't know how to pronounce anything in Vietnamese. So.
Okay.
So here we are. But yeah, they're like the really springy Vietnamese beef meatballs. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of talking about it on the last episode. Was that the last episode? Yeah, it was, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. And you hypothesized that part of the reason why they get that springiness is because they have starch in them. And I was like, yeah, that's probably the case. Mm-hmm. But I looked it up after. Sometimes while I'm editing, I'm like listening and I'm like, oh, I'm actually really curious about that. Right. So I'll just like go and start and do some digging or whatever. And I did some digging. And from what I could find, none of the recipes that I saw use starch of any kind.
Really?
It's just like, yeah, it's just like a really, really intensely worked sausage. Like, mm-hmm. it's just like worked to the point of being paste, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And yeah, gets super springy. So I don't know. I found a few recipes and none of them mentioned any kind of binding starch or anything. And they were all like, you know, like they showed pictures and like, you know, at first it's like, looks like a meatball. Then it look kind of looks like a sausage mix. Then it kind of looks like a sausage mix that somebody's trying to destroy. And then after that, it looks like mortadella or something. It's just right. like, it's so, yeah.
But
yeah.
I understand, like, so it's just interesting to me because it's not just how finely ground it is, because
right.
even something as finely ground as mortadella doesn't quite have the resilient
that texture.
Spring that, and it's not, and not
no,
just,
but,
sorry, go ahead.
Well, because mortadella is like very finely ground, mm-hmm. like extremely finely ground, mm-hmm. but maybe not worked as much. But this right. is worked to the point of being that broken, you know, like.
And so it's interesting because that's like one of the things that I harp on in sausage making classes is that like mm-hmm. an important part of the process, like after you have the ground meat, you're usually adding a little bit of liquid, and it's that mixing afterwards that helps it all kind of bind together and develops that even for not for something as dramatically rubbery as the Vietnamese meatballs, but that gives the sausage that characteristic cohesive springiness.
Yeah.
And usually we do, like, I'll add, say, like 5% of the weight of the meat in water or whatever liquid, and then I'll just paddle it for like a minute and a half or 2 minutes in a stand mixer. Yeah. And oftentimes people will ask, like, okay, so that's what's happening. Like, we're kind of working this mix to develop myosin and protein network that gives it that texture. Like, can we overmix it? Is it, because I often use like the kneading bread analogy and say, like, we're mixing this with water to develop proteins. And so they ask, like, well, can you overmix it? And I always say, like, well, maybe you can, but like, even if I paddled it for 5 minutes on high speed, like, it would be firmer, but I didn't think it would ever reach something that was so dramatic as these Vietnamese as meatballs.
That, yeah. I mean, totally. And you have more experience making sausage than I do. And this was just sort of a quick glance through a few recipes. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that occurs to me, is that potentially like the water content is lower or something like that.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe the water content is lower and the salt content is slightly higher, because I know that the salt content can also affect that like myosin cohesion and stuff like that as right? So, yeah. I don't know. It's probably something with the ratio and then the amount of mixing, I guess.
Interesting. Okay.
Or maybe I'm just not finding the right secret recipe.
They omit it from all the recipes, so that would be...
It's always a possibility.
Yeah.
That's why I like to do a lot of cross-referencing, though.
Okay, well, now I want to find... I want to, next time I'm making sausage, take some of it and paddle it and for 5 minutes on high speed.
I mean, probably longer than 5 minutes, honestly. Like, you should see what it looks like in these recipes. It's just like, yeah, it's just like paste. Another thing that we were talking about in the last episode was that there are transcripts of our show available in the Apple Podcasts app, going back like a few months. And you asked me if it's possible to search the entire catalog of the podcast. And so I went digging to try and find that out. And it looks like it's not. So I think right now you have to search one show at a time.
Right.
But I can think of several easy fixes for that. Like, one easy fix would be to take all of those transcripts and put them into a single searchable document.
Right.
Okay. So that will be something that will be on the roadmap for our Patreon.
Cool.
Is to have like a fully searchable indexed transcript of every episode, so that if people want to look for things, if they think that we've mentioned something and they want to go back and figure out where we talked about it. Might be a little ways down the road. There's some additional complications there with just like, you know, being able to search and also find like time codes and things like that, so that you can actually go back and listen to it.
Right.
But yeah, eventually that will happen.
Cool.
Another little piece of feedback. I've been boycotting Superstore for like 3-4 weeks now. And wings are still expensive over there, so I don't know what's happening.
Yeah, I was texting you. It was, I think we found out that it was right after the formal boycott had ended, but yeah, didn't seem any less busy at Superstore the last few times I was there. But
yeah, I'm curious. I like, you know, a few weeks ago I was seeing a lot of stories that were like, oh yeah, you know, the boycott, it's working. They're noticing. And yeah, I haven't heard anything about it in like 2 or 3 weeks now. And so I don't know. And the wings are still expensive, more expensive than the drums. I went and checked, though. I guess that's another piece of follow-up. I've been checking the prices of wings versus drums. I actually wrote it down, but I don't want to go digging around and try and find it now. But I did write down the pricing at like three different stores, the price difference between drums and wings. And yeah, wings are still quite a bit more expensive than drums, sadly. And I just wanted to touch on briefly also, if there are, I think, like, you know, I talked quite a bit about the Patreon last week, but there was just a couple things that I wanted to clear up in case anyone was confused about it. Oh, and also, I guess I have to correct myself on something. I thought when I posted our like bonus episodes over there, mm-hmm. I made it so that there was like a 2-minute clip of each one that was available. But then I went and joined like as a free, like you can join as a free user, but you don't really get access to the content. But I assumed that that would give you access to like the clips that okay. I had said would be accessible to anyone. Mm. But I wasn't able to listen to anything. So I don't know. I'll have to figure that out. I think that it's still a thing, but maybe I just got the settings wrong or something. So if you went and tried to listen to those clips and weren't able to, my apologies. I'll try and figure it out in the next week or so. But we did get the pricing figured out. And so the first tier is $3 Canadian a month. And that gives you access to all of the bonus episodes. Mm-hmm. Then there's another tier that's $5 Canadian a month. And that gives you access to the bonus episodes plus the community conversation over there. So that includes things like topic suggestions, votes on additional content, you know, chatting with us about episodes, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then there's also like an angel tier, which
mom tier.
There's no, yeah, my mom is definitely one of our biggest fans, and she joined that tier. So thanks, Mom. I really appreciate it. But I don't expect that anyone else will probably join that tier. So yeah, maybe I should just rename it to Shale's Mom tier or something like that. But yeah, it is up and running. There's some bonus content over there. As we record this, I'm going to be posting another short bonus episode over there tomorrow, which will be Wednesday, June 19th. Yeah, and we'll continue to do that every off week for the foreseeable future. So definitely go check it out if you're a fan and you want a little bit more food court. Mm-hmm. So, Alan, what's our topic for tonight?
Is the topic obsessions?
Oh man, yeah.
Is that what it is?
Yep. Food obsessions. So, I don't know. This was just like a weird thing that popped. You know, it's funny. Sometimes I'm like full of topics and I'm just like and I guess like there are probably when I'm full of topics and I'm thinking of lots of food topics and stuff, I should just write down more of the ones that I can think of. Right. And historically I have tried to do that, but sometimes I just don't. And then I forget them and then they're just gone off, lost in the ether forever. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a system even to try and get things down quickly, but sometimes I get in the way of myself. But for like the last, I don't know, 3-4 weeks, I've been dealing with what I think could potentially be called writer's block when it comes to podcast topics or okay. something. I just like, I sit down to think about something and then my brain is just like empty. It's just like a hollow, empty, giant white room with nothing in it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, where'd all the topics go? But yesterday, while I was doing the dishes, I was like, oh, what about this thing where I just get obsessed by like a certain food or whatever? And you know, we've talked about lots of these obsessions, I think, on the show before, things that we've like dived into. And I don't know, maybe all of the things that I have on my list for this topic we've already discussed on the show. But I just thought it was an interesting framing to think about, like, you know, like to analyze like a whole bunch of like our cooking obsessions and like try to like rank them. Like, what's the thing you've been most obsessed with, like during your cooking career or during your as a diner or something like that? Like, right. Because like what happens to me is, yeah, I get these like obsessions and then I do all this research and all this like eating if I have access to the food, and then, you know, like, and it just goes on for a long time until I don't know, satisfy my obsession with it or whatever. And I just thought it would be fun to rank them. So we're going to do our top three.
I didn't know we were ranking. I have to think about this for a sec.
Yeah. I mean, you don't, it's tough to rank. I mean, there's a lot of criteria on which you can rank them. And so I think it's kind of silly, honestly, to try and rank them. But like, I don't know. Like, I, at least for the three that I thought of, and maybe I'm missing something, but for the three that I thought of, it's like pretty, it's pretty clear cut, like what the biggest one was, at least for sure.
I can't wait to hear what it is.
Okay. All right, well, let's get started then. I'll start. Do you want to go back and forth?
Sure.
Start with our number three. Okay.
Sure.
Okay, so for my number three, I have drum roll, put in drum roll sound effect. Who's going to do that? Oh, it's going to be me. Okay. I have Liège waffles.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is a pretty big one for me. So originally...
growing up as a small boy in Liège.
In Liège. Yeah, exactly. I've actually never been to Liège, so.
Oh, okay.
That's kind of sad. But I had waffles in the same style as Liège waffles when I was in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. It's like a Amsterdam street food staple, Liège waffles. And I kind of fell in love with them. I was like, wow, this is like... pretty different from anything that I've had and really delicious. And should I talk about them a little bit? So they're like, I mean, probably most people know what they are now. There's like these big chunky waffles with big, what are the waffle holes called? With big waffle holes in them.
Yeah.
And they're, unlike most waffles, which are usually made with like a batter that's often quick leavened.
Yep.
Liège waffles are made with a sweet dough that's similar to like a, I guess kind of similar to a brioche dough or something like that, but it's leavened with yeast. Mm-hmm. And so they have this like really delicious, like fermented bready characteristic. And like one of the hallmarks is that there are like big chunks of sugar, like huge rocks. It's called pearl sugar that are like throughout the dough. And so when you bake them, like you get these large chunks of sugar that are like throughout the waffle, but then also the ones that are near the outside of the waffle caramelize while the waffle is cooking. Mm-hmm. And so you basically get like a candy coating on the outside of this like really delicious, light, crispy, beautifully leavened waffle.
Right.
And yeah, so it was a new experience for me when I tried them in Amsterdam. I was like, whoa, this is kind of blowing my mind. What's the deal here? I thought about them a lot, but I didn't really like have much opportunity to make them because you kind of it requires specialized equipment and stuff like that. But I got an opportunity once I had been back in Canada for a few years to like really do a deep dive of research on how they're made and what the doughs are like. I did that research for a small cafe that I helped open for the Black Box restaurant group that was in a train station in Edmonton. It was called Burrow Cafe, after a burrowing owl. I don't know. I'm also obsessed with owls, so this is good.
You are?
Yeah, man, I love owls. And burrowing owls especially are just like, oh my God.
Did you know that I got to hold a burrowing owl 2 weeks ago?
Oh, what? Where?
At the Beaver Hills Bird Observatory Big Birding Breakfast.
Wow.
I'll send you some pictures.
This is please not... do. Man, they're so cute.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, so I did a bunch of research, a bunch of recipe trials in conjunction with Erica, who was, I think at that time working as the baker at District Cafe. Mm-hmm. It's hard to remember all the timelines, but yeah, kind of in conjunction with Erica working on like dough recipes and methods for cooking them. And we just did like a super deep dive. I was like working on waffle stuff, like not exclusively, but probably like 65% of my weekly effort was going into researching and testing waffles and finding waffle making equipment,
right.
For like a few months before we opened that shop. And then once that shop was up and running, I was probably the one who was there the most cooking waffles for like months and months and months, just like going down there, cooking waffles for people's breakfast and then cleaning up and going home for the day. And, yeah, so I got to know them pretty intimately. And then we wound up putting them on the brunch menu at District when I helped open District. And so we made a lot of waffles there as well. And, so I got to find out about them, learn about them, then do a crazy in-depth deep dive. And then I got to cook them for months and got pretty good at cooking them.
Right.
I don't know. There's a lot. I feel like it would have been better if I could have gone to somewhere, Amsterdam or Liège, when we were like trying to do that research and right. actually figure out how they handle some of the problems that you can run into. Some of the problems are like, there's so much sugar that you just wind up, everything gets so sticky and stuff.
Right. I think that I've only tried to make them at home once. And that was a huge issue, was I basically ended up with like hard, dark, sticky caramel in my waffle iron. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And how I wound up solving that problem. Well, solving is a strong word, but basically how we wound up dealing with that problem was after every couple of waffles that we cooked, we just used like a dry pastry brush to like pull out all of the caramelized sugar from the bottom of the waffle iron.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would harden on the pastry brush. And I just had like 5 or 6 brushes and I would just like let the sugar dissolve off of them in like a little bucket of water that I had beside the station. And I'd pull out, you know, one that had been soaking for a little while and the sugar was off it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would dry it out and use that one and then put it in to soak and then grab the next one. And yeah, it was quite a process. I don't know if that's what it's like. There's also like the waffle irons that we had, you weren't able to flip them. But that can really help even out how much sugar is in like the top or the bottom of the waffle iron. Like there right. are waffle irons where when you put the waffle in, you can like flip it over like 180 yes. degrees.
Yeah.
So then, you know, the sugar from the last waffle drips onto the top of the next waffle. And I think that that's probably like one of the big things, but mm-hmm. those waffle irons were quite a bit more expensive and harder to get. And so we didn't wind up with them. So I'd be curious to be able to use one of those at some point. But anyway, that's my number three. Liège waffles.
Is calling it a Belgian waffle, is that kind of silly the same way that we refer to Swiss cheese? Like there's a whole bunch of kinds of Swiss cheese that are all very distinct, or like is just a Belgian, because in North America, Belgian waffle, it really is just referring to the shape, right? Like it might not be a Liège waffle right. because it doesn't have the pearl sugar in it. But for us,
here's what I think about that.
Okay.
And also, I think in most cases, Belgian waffles are probably not yeast leavened. A lot of Belgian waffles that you can buy in like restaurants
mm-hmm.
or whatever right. are just like quick leavened.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's what I think about that. Like when I say Swiss cheese, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Appenzeller. Just kidding. Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Alan, I didn't say alpine cheese.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You mean American Swiss cheese with holes in it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like kind of a low grade imitation of
the cheese of like, that cartoon mice eat.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah. That's Swiss cheese. And I think the same thing goes for Belgian waffles. You know, like the Belgian waffles are like thick waffles with big, like,
say big it, waffle holes.
Sorry. Sorry, everyone. I don't know what they're called.
Waffle pockets. Dimples, divots.
Dimples, sure. We'll call them dimples. yeah, like Belgian waffles. I think it's like a shape of waffle, like you said. Big dimples, big waffle. That's a Belgian waffle. Mm-hmm. But when you say Liège waffle, that means something more specific.
Right.
That is like more, I think, authentic to, you know, that particular. But, you know, I don't think like those what are called Liège waffles are like pretty common throughout that sort of area in Europe as a street food. Mm-hmm. And I think in Amsterdam when I had them, they were called Liège waffles. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure. Or maybe they were just called waffles. I don't know.
Is there anyone making those specifically in Edmonton right now?
Hmm.
There was a little truck, right? Was it called
Wonuts?
No. Was it called Eva Sweet? Am I making that up?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know if Eva Sweet still exists or not. Yeah, I don't know if that's still around. But yeah, the Eva Sweet was making those types of waffles. Mm-hmm. And in fact, yeah, at a certain point for the waffles that we were making at District Cafe, I think we were purchasing some from them. I remember. When we did a few like chicken and waffles events and stuff.
Right.
When for Elm. Yeah. And then and when we did those events, we purchased our waffles from Eva Sweet. So that was before I had done all that research and stuff.
And then later it became chicken and donuts. It was a sandwich made on a donut with donuts. Right.
And where did we get those donuts, Alan?
Take five.
Yeah. It's all coming together. Alan and I don't want to go too far off on a tangent or anything, but Alan and I today had lunch in the Beverly area, mm-hmm. and that's where Take Five Donuts is. And that's like a Edmonton donut institution. They have good donuts there, and it's an old shop place.
Yes. Cash only. Good. No cards there, just so you know.
Really? Oh, I haven't been there in a while.
But, well, we can have a whole episode maybe on Old Town Beverly sometime.
Yeah, we're going to have to, I think.
But I'm going to just jump in because there's a bit of a segue here. We're talking about chicken and waffle sandwiches at Elm and chicken and donut sandwiches at Elm. My number three spot is actually sandwiches.
Oh, well, that's broad.
No, yeah. Oh, and they're going to get, wait until you hear my number two. It's maddeningly broad. I picked sandwiches because it's not exactly what you're describing where it's like, okay, there's this one specific preparation and I'm going to learn everything mm-hmm. that I can possibly learn about this one traditional preparation. But I feel like sandwiches have to be on my list because for years, every day we had to come up with new sandwiches. And so it was kind of like, obviously on the one hand, the possibilities are endless, but like when you actually have to come up with new inventive ones every single day, it can be exhausting and you get to see, but it's cool because you get to try so many different things and see what works and what doesn't. And I'm glad that it's not part of my day-to-day life now, but having to do that for so long, despite any frustration, I do look back on it very fondly. And to give folks an idea, when I started at Elm, you were the chef, and if I remember right, every day there were at least three completely new sandwiches on the menu.
Yeah.
So every day, three new ones. And I think by the time I was there, there was a little bit of a almost like calendar planning. And obviously some sandwiches would be duplicated, maybe like month over month, or I can't remember what the rotation was. It was like a 3 or 4 week rotation perhaps over the season.
Yeah, that's right.
But every day there were new ones on the menu. Over the course of time, that like mostly to streamline production and procurement and everything, like it did become much more focused and not just like a completely new menu every day.
Right.
But
yeah, we wound up with some standards.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Some features. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was a fun exercise. First of all, diving into traditional sandwiches and not just like the like North American lunch counter staples, but like I remember like when I traveled, I was interested in regional sandwiches, whether it's like totally. Obvious ones like pastrami in New York, or I think we've talked about this on the show, but one of the most memorable sandwiches I had was in Florence in Italy, and it was a beef stomach sandwich. Do you remember talking about that?
No, I don't know if I remember talking about it on the show.
It's called Lampredotto, and okay. traditional to Florence, but I had it at the central market in Florence. I say that Mercato Centrale or whatever.
Okay.
And it was memorable for a few reasons. First of all, it was the second most hungover I've ever been in my entire life.
Oh, no.
And we were trying to get lunch at the market. There was a long line for this vendor. Are you sure we haven't told this story?
I don't think so, honestly.
So a long line.
And in fact, this story sounds like entirely fresh to me. Like maybe I haven't really heard it before. Like maybe I've heard you talk about the sandwich, but not the story. I don't know.
Well, sorry, there's not much of a plot or anything, but...
Well, I was getting pretty invested.
Huge line.
It's kind of a character piece, I think. Huge.
It's a think piece. A sandwich yeah. think piece. Huge lineup. So we're like, this must be good. I can barely stand, but I will wait in line for this sandwich. Get to the front of the line, and there is a huge pot of simmering liquid. Looks like mm-hmm. stock. Like you can see like the foam coming to the surface and stuff like that. They've got a pile of round crusty buns, and they cut it open. And it's kind of like, you know, we've talked about this, like when you wait in line, it's annoying. But then when you get to the front of the line and the person who's serving you, like has all the time in the world for you, and you feel like
yeah.
they are there to, I don't know. It just, we talked about it, I think specifically with Salt and Straw in Portland, where it's just like mm-hmm. you're thinking about getting out of the line at any minute because it's taking so long. But then like once you're there, like you really feel like they are listening to you and serving
it's
you.
It's a great
and,
feeling. Yeah.
So it was like that. So he says, so we have the crusty bun cut in half. Do you want green oil? Yes. And so they have like this herb oil that they smear all over the bun. And do you want chili oil? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or red oil? Yes. And they smear chili oil all over the inside of the bun.
Christmas.
And then they take tongs and they go fishing in this big pot of simmering broth, and they pull out beef stomach. And they chop it up and they put it on the bun and they pass it to you. Uh-huh. And so it like, I don't think I'd had tripe before, but this was something a little bit different. Like it was a little bit more
yeah.
meaty, and it was like kind of like a braise, but it was just beautiful, falling apart, moist, tender, shredded, chopped beef stomach with herb and chili oil. Really wonderful. But yeah, the having to constantly come up with new sandwiches had me looking to traditional things like that. We never served beef stomach, I don't think.
Oh, that was going to be the climax of the story.
Oh, yeah.
You ran beef stomach sandwich at Elm, and nobody bought.
No
one
bought it,
one.
And I was fired the next week. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
traditional sandwiches, and then also like they're like. And places like Faro still do this all the time, but like looking at any kind of traditional dish and thinking about mm-hmm. how to make it into a sandwich.
Turn it into a sandwich. Yeah, exactly.
And then there's kind of just like the freewheeling, like flavor dynamics approach where it's like, okay, well, like we've got beef short rib, and then you have this idea, like, you know what I like? I really like, I had this stew that was beef and prunes in Greece, and like yeah. beef and prunes is so delicious, and it sounds weird, but I'm gonna put it on a sandwich and we'll put some kind of slaw, I don't know, but that's what I got, Shil, sandwiches there.
Yeah, number three, sandwiches. That's a big one. It's funny, like obviously at that time that I was working at Elm and I was the chef at Elm, I had to do a lot of thinking about sandwiches in a very similar way. Mm. But yeah, it doesn't really make my obsession list for some reason, because I think, like, I don't know, maybe it was just like over such a long period of time that it was like crests and valleys, or like waves of like me being like, you know, really into finding new information or new sandwiches or something.
And then really hating it.
Or maybe not hating it, but just because it's so stretched out that there was like peaks and valleys. And I just don't, it doesn't, that to me doesn't seem like a focused, like, you know,
right,
obsession for me or something, because it was over such a long period of time. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll give you my number two. Also, in my list, I have an honorable mention. But I don't want to say what my honorable mention is until I'm about to tell you my number one.
Okay.
So if I forget about my honorable mention, you have to remind me.
Okay.
Before I move on to my number one. My number two is sandwiches. Just kidding. But in a way, it's kind of sandwiches. My number two is shuk bun.
Okay.
So
what is that again?
Which is Japanese milk bread. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I got obsessed with it was because of sandwiches.
Right.
So, yeah. So it's kind of interesting. Originally, I think, you know, how I sort of, I mean, I think I knew that it existed, but it wasn't really a part of my culinary repertoire or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But just like a couple of years ago, I was really into Kenji Lopez Alt. Still am. Love that guy. Mm. So great. Such a smart cook. Oh, he has a new podcast, by the way.
Oh, is that right?
I don't know. Yeah. It's called The Recipe, and it's, or The Recipe with Kenji and Deb. And it's him and another food blogger named Deb. Oh, can't remember her name. Anyway. She has a food blog called Smitten Kitchen. Mm-hmm. And basically they both have like hundreds of recipes that they've developed. And so they just pick a topic and then they cook each other's recipe for that thing.
Okay.
Or maybe a couple of them if they have variations. Mm-hmm. And then they get together and talk about like, why was your recipe like this? And why did you decide to do this? And I really like this about your recipe, but I didn't like this about it. And it's pretty interesting. Mm,
cool.
Yeah. Good show. But listen to our podcast and then go listen to the recipe.
Okay.
anyway, yeah, I was watching a lot of Kenji's videos and there were a few, where he made sandwiches and he was, I think like in his grilled cheese recipe and like a couple other sandwich recipes that he gave, he was like, I really like making sandwiches on shokupan because it's like, just got these really great characteristics. It's like soft and chewy, but it's kind of springy and it's like, you know, more dense and more yeasty than regular white bread. And it's just got a really great texture, but it doesn't really get in the way of the flavors of the sandwich. And mm-hmm. I was like, I want to make these Kenji sandwiches, but I don't know where to get shokupan. Mm-hmm. And so I started down a road of like trying to figure out how to make some at home. I borrowed like a Pullman loaf pan from Erica and I made some that way. And the pan was a little small, but I made it work. I fell down this rabbit hole of like trying to see what it would be like to try and order pans from Japan and like bring them home. And then part of doing that research kind of was like why I wound up going to Japan. Like I've always been interested in Japan, but traveling there always seemed kind of intimidating or something. But like, and I mean, I love Japanese food and I've always wanted to go there to like try the food and stuff like that. But it just seemed like a lot. But after doing all of the research that I'd done into like trying to find places that had pans and that led me down some other like Japanese food kind of rabbit holes that I went down. And then a friend of mine was going and was like, hey, you should come while we're there. Mm-hmm. And that just like tipped it over into, okay, now I'd been doing all this research and I'd been thinking so much about Japanese food. And then my friend was like, hey, we're going to Japan. And then I was like, I'm going to Japan. Like, yeah. And then I went to Japan and I brought back everything that I needed to make shokupan. And I've made it several times since I got back. And I mean, Kenji's right. It's amazing. And yeah, I mean, like, I not like most of my like food obsessions slash recipe obsessions don't result in me going to the place where that food is made and bringing back equipment to make it with. And so I feel like that alone kind of gives it the oomph that it needs to be in my number two spot.
And what's the best sandwich that you've made on your show coupon?
Oh, what a good question.
Surely probably the best egg salad, right?
It is. Yeah, it is. The egg salad sandwiches that I made on my homemade shokupan were probably the best sandwiches that I made. But I've made a bunch of other good ones too, like pork cutlet, like tonkatsu sandwich and chicken katsu sandwich and just grilled cheese sandwiches. Like last year, when I first got back and I was making a loaf of shokupan like every week, like a lot of the sandwiches that I ate on it were like Kenji's tomato sandwich.
Wait, yeah, you've talked about that. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And those are so good. Like if you have good tomatoes and it's just like tomatoes and mayonnaise on like really nice shokupan and you grill the inside of it. Mm. Oh man. It's unbelievable.
If you've got good family heirloom tomatoes, right?
That's right. Exactly. So that's my number two, shokupan, number two obsession.
Okay.
I could have a list of 10 here, just so that we're clear.
Yeah.
Like that would be a too long of a podcast episode, but like, yeah, I've had a lot of food obsessions.
Mm-hmm. My number two is, it maybe doesn't like have the kind of through line, going over my whole career, but it's Jewish delis. The style of New York and Montreal. And it's just it was an interesting time in my career where there was a couple jobs and projects that were winding down right before the opening of June's Delicatessen here in Edmonton. And I had time to do a really deep dive, lots of reading and eating and experimenting. The kinds of there was a lot of places in New York and Montreal that I had already visited, but then got to do a lot of reading about them, like read, for instance, the Russ and Daughters family history book and Save the Deli by David Sachs, and just like pouring over menus. And then, yeah, trying to dive into some of the specific preparations. It was like I was totally spoiled with the time and resources to do that kind of legwork, or sorry, that kind of deep research and stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was really fun. And again, like I don't like June's is closed and I don't work in a Jewish deli or anything, but yeah, in terms of deep dives, that was one of the most fun, one of the most fun ones. And it wasn't, especially because it wasn't just, we weren't just trying to, like, duplicate a certain restaurant. Like we still wanted to try and make it make sense in Edmonton, but just doing even something as simple as like understanding that, say, like the patriarch of Russ and Daughters, like actually came from really the same part of Europe that a lot of Albertan, like people who identify as Ukrainian Albertan right now, like he's basically from the same region. And so there were so many interesting kind of overlaps, like with borscht and cabbage rolls and things like that, where obviously it's made a little bit different in the Jewish tradition, obviously wouldn't have pork and stuff like that. But yeah, it was a really fun project and definitely the most time and resources I've had to devote to a project that ended up being a real restaurant. Like it wasn't just like, you know, a hobby project, I guess. But, yeah.
What do you think, do you have like some favorite discoveries from that time? Things that you like, I don't know, maybe you make them at home now, or, you know, like you wish you had opportunity to make them, or.
I think, well, actually it's funny you should mention, one of the dishes that we developed for the June's brunch menu is basically going to be on the menu at Ernest's for lunch services in the fall. And that's Blintzes.
Oh, right. The Blintzes. Yeah.
So we did developed a recipe for gluten-free buckwheat crepes and have a cottage cheese filling for them. And so that was on the June's menu. It was in a French toast kind of vein, loaded with fruit, and it had your apple butter on it. And so right. It's going to be a little bit pushed more towards a savory appetizer in the fall, but we have a goat cheese blintz with apple, walnut, and tarragon. But the blintz itself is basically what we made at June's, just with goat cheese instead of cottage cheese. And we've probably talked about this too, but the one dish and recipe that I was really proud to use there was that the matzo ball soup with the matzo balls coming from Twyla Campbell's biography of Gail Hall. I thought I was really excited to have that kind of local tie-in. And it was a delicious, the matzo ball recipe is great. And we had a nice hearty chicken broth to serve it in. So
yum. Wish I could go get one of those right now.
Sorry.
Maybe we can make some sometime.
Yeah, totally.
Put that on the lunch menu. Cool. Delis. That's a good one. Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good deep dive. And it feels so good to be able to do something like I don't know. It's sort of like for me, when I get obsessed with a certain kind of food, it doesn't really matter if it's for a project or not or what. I just go crazy, trying to learn as much as I possibly can about it. Mm-hmm. But it is a really great feeling to, be given time to do that research for an actual restaurant project or something. It just mm-hmm. feels good. It feels very productive and very constructive to be able to do that work with the end result of being able to roll it out and serve it to customers.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Totally.
That's great. Moving on.
Now it's honorable mention time. Is that right?
Oh, good job, Alan. You reminded me. Yeah. It's time for my honorable mention. My honorable mention, I'll try to keep this short, is ice cream.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
The reason why it's an honorable mention, even though it's probably one of the things that I've done the most research and the most learning about in my entire culinary career, is just because it feels a little unfair because it's just been such a big part of my life for the last 5 years, and I've had ample opportunity to continue to do research about it and continue learning about it mm-hmm. Over the course of that period of time. And I don't know, it's not my journey with it is there's no end point or whatever. And then also, it just since it's what I'm actively doing right now, it just feels like it would be unfair to use it in this context.
No one would accuse you of it, of being unfair for picking ice cream, but
okay, that's fair. Then I changed my whole order. No, I'm just kidding. Honorable mention goes to ice cream. It's my runner up, I guess. Maybe actually Chocopan's my number three.
Right. Yeah.
but anyway, moving on to my number one, drum roll. It's pho.
Really?
Yes. So pho is probably for me the food that in my entire lifetime I've had the longest running obsession with. The most kind of, man, it's I love ramen. Mm-hmm. I loved going to Japan and being able to try ramen. We talk often about how I've been thinking about ramen since 2011 or whatever. And whenever Chang was blowing up and Momofuku and all that stuff that we always talk about. Yeah, since Chang invented ramen. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we talk about that a lot. And so, you know, like clearly ramen would be something that's kind of on this list, like one of my food obsessions, mm-hmm. right? But like, it's so far eclipsed by my obsession with pho that like, it doesn't, yeah, it doesn't make the top three. Like,
right.
And the reason why that is because A, like, I was eating pho like three times a week before being a cook as my career was like even on my radar at all. Mm-hmm. Like long time ago, I like lived in Calgary and worked as like a multimedia computer support tech and stuff. And basically like while I was there living there doing that job, there was like quite a few pho places in downtown Calgary, and some friends of mine that worked at the office brought me to one of these places one day. I don't even remember what it's called. I remember where it's located, but I can't remember what it's called. But it was sort of like I had like pho Thai, so just like pho with steak on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of instantly fell in love with it. And then for like a long time while I was living in Calgary, I was eating that like two or three times a week. Like I would just go out for lunch from work and we would get pho.
Mm-hmm.
And then that like, you know, basically continued for years until I was like, you know, living in Vancouver and cooking, and I was still like finding great pho restaurants and trying to find the best pho restaurants in Vancouver and go to them. And,
mm-hmm.
and then, finally, like when I moved back to Edmonton from Vancouver, and before I went to Europe, the time, like I spent a year and a half cooking at the Blue Pear restaurant. And during that time I was eating pho at King Noodle.
Yep.
Basically like three times a week for like most of the time that I worked there.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably the food that I've eaten the most of in my whole life.
Right.
Like I would think like by this point, I don't know, maybe Honey Nut Cheerios or something from when I was a kid. I don't know. But like when I think about the amount of it that I've eaten, it's like staggering. When I went to Europe, like there's such amazing food there. But like basically the whole time I was living in Copenhagen, I was lamenting the fact that there was no good pho there.
Right.
I went to every pho restaurant in Copenhagen and there was nothing that was comparable to anything that you can get in Calgary, Vancouver, or Edmonton.
Mm-hmm.
Still never been to Vietnam, but...
Oh,
it's on the bucket list.
Like, do you ever make pho, or is that not what this obsession is about?
Well, so then it just so happened that during a certain point in my career in Edmonton, I was like between places where I was at, and a good friend of mine, Linda Ha, her parents had like owned a Vietnamese restaurant, and she was sort of like trying to help them out a little bit with some marketing. And so I got an opportunity to work with her mom there, who was the chef, and basically learn how to make pho from her mom.
Mm-hmm.
And for like, I worked there for, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, before the whole concept kind of fell apart, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to work there making pho every day. You know, for like 4 or 5 months,
mm-hmm.
that and salad rolls and a few other Vietnamese things, spring rolls and some other stuff that her mom taught me. But
right.
I got to then do like a deep dive and also like do some, like make my own inventions with it and stuff like that. Like we had a vegan pho on the menu that I basically designed the recipe for, which was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really popular and people really liked it. And yeah, so I do get to make pho. I don't make it at home very often. It's quite a process.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, to me, it sort of feels more like a, I don't know. It doesn't really feel like a home dish to me.
Right.
Maybe that's incorrect. You know, maybe lots of people have pho at home in Vietnam, but to me, it sort of feels like a go out to eat it. Kind of like, yeah, I don't know. Maybe this is like an incorrect conception, but like not very many people eat like ramen at home in Japan in the same way that it's served in a restaurant. Right. And I think it might be similar for pho in Vietnam. Like people usually go to a restaurant or go to a stand to eat it or have somebody drive by or like ride by on a bicycle with like bowls of pho. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I've heard crazy stuff about street vendors in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty interesting. But yeah, I would say that's my biggest one. And I got to actually learn from a Vietnamese chef who is like really amazing and really got to satisfy my desire to cook that food in a restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So yeah, that's my number one. Pho.
I'm hungry.
What's your number one, Alan?
Well, my honorable mentions.
Oh, you got one too. Great.
Like any traveling that I've done usually either starts with or results in a deep obsession with the cuisine. And so I won't belabor it, but like, especially the longer trips that I've been able to do for me, it's all been in Europe, but I've done month or 5 week trips to Greece, to Austria and to Italy. And those all sent me, I think I tried to do research before I went, but then having been there and tasted the food and learned a bit, like it's in all three of those cases, it sent me down the rabbit hole in a really fun way. So yeah, any of those could have probably been on my list, especially Austria. But my number one is actually, and I like this because it is this kind of through line through a lot of the jobs that I've had and even the job, like the course that I'll be teaching at Nate this fall, and it's charcuterie.
Right.
I don't think anything has had a bigger effect on my culinary interests and skills than Michael Rollman's and Brian Polson's book, Charcuterie. I remember the day that I heard about that book and I read, it was like on a blog where they're like, oh, like I made bacon at home from this book called Charcuterie. And I literally went to Chapters that afternoon and bought the book. And yeah, started to experiment with bacon and sausage making, curing and smoking of all sorts and sausage making, and was able to use those skills again and again at almost every kitchen that I've worked in, from making fresh sausage at Jack's Grill in a fine dining setting to, making sausage at Zalt's, like trying to scale that up into, a bigger sausage centric, business at Zalt's, making corn.
Well, and before that, like making cured meats for Elm and stuff that for certain
corn
sandwiches.
Beef for sandwiches and then making, trying to get a Montreal style smoked meat at June's and now, and it's been really fun because it seems like kind of peripheral to like cooking in a way or like adjacent, but it's just kind of like followed me everywhere. I've taken it everywhere that I've gone and worked it onto menus, and it's a really rewarding skill set, that kind of like transformation that happens in those recipes. So yeah, that's my number one, charcuterie.
That's a good one. I'll say this about your obsession with charcuterie. It's resulted in me having some really spectacular, memorable meals. So awesome. Thanks for being obsessed with that. And also due to that, there are a lot of people who have had memorable meals thanks to your obsession with charcuterie. So
thanks, Jill.
That's lucky. We better end the show before I cry.
Oh.
Hey, listeners. You can help support Food Court and access great bonus content by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/foodcourtpod. If subscriptions aren't your thing, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Food Court is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Your hosts are Alan Sedeby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan McDonald. To get new episodes on the day they're released, follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from you all. please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at foodcourtpodcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.